British politics has gotten more chaotic in the fortnight since the referendum to leave the European Union. Prime Minister David Cameron will be replaced soon by Britain's second woman Prime Minister. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has lost the support of about 80% of his parliamentary colleagues, but he does remain popular among the Labour Party members who voted for him. The reputation of the former Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair sinks even lower as the Chilcot report into the lead-up to and the aftermath of the 2003 Iraq War just damns Blair's enthusiasm for war. So to explain Britain's recent crises, let's speak to Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, and Robert Hayward, a Conservative member of the House of Lords, formerly in the Commons. He's now a Tory sophologist. Thank you both for joining me, gentlemen.
Hello.
And Robert Hayward, a Conservative member of the House of Lords, formerly in the Commons, and now a Tory party sophologist. Welcome to you, Robert.
Good morning.
Tim, if I could start with you and the fallout from the release of Sir John Chilcot's inquiry into Britain's role in the Iraq War. The report was damning of Tony Blair's decision to follow the US into Iraq. But the former Prime Minister, he says he takes full responsibility for his mistakes, but he's insistent that he made the right decision. I can't understand how he squares the two. Can you explain it?
Well, I think, to be honest, that Tony Blair has spent so many years defending his position that he isn't going to resile from it now. I mean, the personal as well as the political costs for him would simply be too great. So he still maintains, I think, that Saddam Hussein was a danger to his people, if not to the rest of the world, as we thought at the time, and that actually, in the end, the best thing to do would be to go ahead with the action. I think also, to be honest, the subtext of the report is the fact that he was so keen to preserve the special relationship with the United States, both for diplomatic and perhaps for electoral reasons, that he felt he had no choice. So I just don't think we're ever going to get a change out of Tony Blair.
Tim, does he look like a pure supplicant to George Bush?
I don't think so. I think the detail of the Chilcot report, and obviously I can't claim to have read all 2.6 million words.
Oh, well, you're very negligent then. It's been out for 12 hours.
He did try to play a restraining role. He did try to get the Americans to the United Nations again. He did try to give them some idea about, you know, how the rest of the world, both in the Middle East and Europe, was feeling. But I think that was all undermined, and this comes out of the Chilcot report, you know, very strongly, by the fact that in the end, the Americans knew that they could count on him, whatever the qualifications and the mitigations he was making. And in the end, you know, that meant that we were going to war. But the most worrying thing, I think, is what it revealed about cabinet government, or the lack thereof. Blair seems to have gone ahead with this, really, without keeping his colleagues on board as he went, and then gave them a fait accompli right at the end and didn't give them much choice.
Tony Blair was adamant that this report sort of settles the allegation that he lied and deceived the British Parliament. But the report does suggest that he misled the House of Commons about the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. He presented the judgments, I think, in Chilcot's words, with a certainty that was not justified. So he exaggerated. How is this not lying, Tim?
To be fair as we can be to Tony Blair on this, he would argue that the intelligence he got was similarly certain. And I think there was a degree of groupthink right throughout British and American government that Saddam must have these weapons, did have these weapons. And if the intelligence wasn't really as hard as it could have been, that was because the intelligence wasn't good enough, not because Saddam didn't have the weapons of mass destruction. So I think it is probably true to say that he wasn't actually bare-faced lying to the House of Commons when he made that statement.
Robert, it's widely agreed that with evidence to support the claim that the war in Iraq was one of the direct causes of the rise of Islamic State. In fact, it was incubated in the jails of Iraq, in Camp Booker. And yet Tony Blair, and I've got to say Australia's Prime Minister John Howard, still deny the invasion was the cause of the terrorism we see today. How can he possibly maintain that position, especially considering he was saying something different in 2015? Let's hear a little bit of what Tony Blair said in 2015.
Of course, you can't say that those of us who removed Saddam in 2003 bear no responsibility for the situation in 2015. But it's important also to realise that the Arab Spring, which began in 2011, would also have had its impact on Iraq today. And ISIS actually came to prominence from a base in Syria and not in Iraq.
Robert, well, that was Tony Blair speaking to Fareed Zakaria on CNN just last year. He was saying something different, though, wasn't he?
Yes, and I fall into the category of being more of a Blair detractor than Tim Bale, in that although I wouldn't use the word that he lied, he garnered the truth to such an extent that, as far as I'm concerned, when he spoke to Parliament, he had, as Tim identified, ridden, I shan't say roughshod, but fairly heavily over his cabinet and the intelligence advice that he'd received. I think there is a lot for him still to answer. As far as the IS starting in the jails, there are many bases on which IS has grown, not purely the events of 2003.
Yes, although ISIL's first great victory, as they claim it, was Fallujah in Iraq a couple of years ago.
Yes, it was, but you can argue that the whole instability of Iraq stemmed from the invasion, stemmed from the effective removal of the existing Iraqi army. You can identify a whole series of other matters. So I think it's dangerous, almost in any circumstances, to say that something directly arose from an event 13 years earlier.
Tim, Tony Blair is now facing renewed calls for his impeachment, which is a most unusual thing in the British Parliament. I think it last happened in 1806 or something. Is there any chance that he will be impeached, if not prosecuted?
I doubt prosecution is on cards because the ICC have ruled that out. I think impeachment, to be honest, is unlikely. It was interesting to see the reaction of the families. Some of them obviously still want to carry on with this, quite understandably, the families who had people killed in Iraq. Some of them appear to think that Chilcot had given them what they want and actually, you know, made it very clear that Tony Blair was particularly responsible for what went on. So it might not be that they want to press this either. There may be some people who want to do that. But to be honest, I rather suspect that we will try and learn the lessons from this. Tony Blair won't be able to escape the consequences, but it won't end up in an impeachment.
Tim, thank you very much. I do know you have to go. That was Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University in London. Coming back to you, Lord Hayward, Conservative peer, former MP, you're now a political analyst. I know you're a Tory, but you've got a reputation as an independent thinker, Robert. Is Tony Blair's reputation blackened forever, by the way?
I think it is. He achieved other things, as did any Prime Minister, but there will be a question hanging over him for the rest of time in terms of historians who analyse his period as Prime Minister.
Now, let's talk about the leadership angst within both major parties, but I do want to focus on the Conservatives, your party, if only because you're in government and either Theresa May or Andrea Leadsom will be the next British Prime Minister. Tell us about the current front-runner, Theresa May.
Theresa May is what one might describe as the establishment figure. She's been Home Secretary for longer than anybody since the Second World War, so she has a lot of government experience. She doesn't come from a public school. She's the daughter of a vicar. She was cautious, one might say, in her support for Remain on the European referendum, which some people have said was a careful way of ensuring that she was positioned should Cameron fall. Probably reflects her own nature. She is, although a very warm and pleasant person to work with, she is not an outgoing, campaigning, jovial, bar-going politician, and therefore it's her assurance and the solid experience that will either appeal or not appeal to the membership of the party.
Will her support for the Remain camp, you say she was much more sedate about it, but will it in any way jeopardise her chance of being voted in as next leader by the Conservative Party membership? Because I think it was something like two-thirds the membership of the Conservative Party in favour of Leave.
Yes, in broad terms, that figure's about right. We can't be absolutely certain, but my assessment is that it is right. And there's no question that Andrea Leadsom is campaigning on the basis of she is the pure Brexiteer, the one who can deliver the verdict of the party members and the verdict of the nation. The argument that Theresa May will put is that, yes, she was a Remainer, but she's managed to gain the support amongst her campaign team of the likes of Chris Grayling and David Davis and Priti Patel, all of whom were absolutely firm leavers, and that therefore she has an appeal right across the party spectrum. Andrea Leadsom's problem is that while she was a pure leaver, she has the problem that she hasn't got somebody from the Remain side of status to actually campaign for her.
Robert, looking from the outside, we see two strong female candidates for the British Prime Ministership, Andrea Leadsom and Theresa May. And of course, we automatically think of Mrs. Thatcher. But are either of those two women in Thatcher's footsteps? Because hasn't David Cameron set out to effectively de-Thatcherise a lot of the Conservative Party over the past 10 years?
I think both of them would probably be somewhat insulted in a curious way to think that several decades on, we're still talking about Mrs. Thatcher and drawing parallels, but equally both of them will be pleased if they can take on some of that mantle. The party has changed, the nation has changed dramatically, the circumstances of the nation have changed, and therefore we are looking at a very unstable time, which is a parallel to when Margaret Thatcher took over, but a very different multiracial, multicultural society. And the new leader of the Tory party, the new prime minister, will have to appeal to a very different electorate from the one that Mrs. Thatcher inherited.
When you say that they would be partly flattered by the comparison with Mrs. Thatcher, why? Because they admire her personal qualities, or they're ideologically at one with her economic neoliberalism? I'm just wondering where they would be flattered by that comparison.
I think the prime element would be that Mrs. Thatcher, still in the minds of a very large proportion of the population, whether you supported what she did or didn't, has that role of being somebody who achieved a lot for the country. And therefore, the suggestion that you might be the person who can equally achieve a lot for the country, particularly in unstable times, will be an appealing option for both candidates.
And just very briefly, Robert, as I said, I know you're a Tory, but you've got friends on the Labour side. Jeremy Corbyn has apparently lost the support of 80% of the parliamentary membership of his party, yet, you know, he's probably got 60% support within the broader Labour Party outside Parliament. Is this a viable way for a party to continue when 80% of the people sitting behind you wish you were gone?
I think if you'd asked me that question a month ago, I would not have considered the answer I'm just about to give. Circumstances are changing, and I now think there is a possibility that the Labour Party will break up.
Wow.
Because the people who were trying to remove Jeremy Corbyn have recognised that they can't. They would face an election in which the membership would re-elect either Jeremy Corbyn or somebody of his own ilk. And therefore, this huge block of Labour MPs, Labour members of the House of Lords, and a fair number of council leaders around the country have to consider what they do. And under these circumstances, they will either continue within the Labour Party or look elsewhere. And whereas I thought a month ago that was not a serious option, I still don't think it will happen, but I think it's a rising option, and you could find a coalition of the left in different circumstances.
There is one scenario that I've read about where the parliamentary members of the Labour Party elect their own leader and ask the Speaker of the Parliament to recognise their leader as the opposition leader, and Jeremy Corbyn remains as the leader of a movement, as it were, a sort of parallel movement, and they sort of work out what they do at the next election when that next election comes.
And that is clearly one of the options that is being considered. And again, a month ago, I'd have probably described that as almost a fatuous suggestion, but it is a sign of the changing circumstances within the Labour Party that this is now being seriously discussed.
I think Jeremy might like the idea of being Chairman Jeremy or Chairman Corbyn. It has a certain ring to it. Robert Haywood, a Conservative member of the House of Lords, a former member of the House of Commons, now a political analyst, and earlier we were joined by Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University at the University of London. Robert, thank you very much for being with us on Saturday Extra.
Not at all. Thank you.